from pop culture to politics, this is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, a great day following our great national holiday, Birthing People's Day. No, that's basically the woke way to address what we just experienced with Mother's Day. I hope everybody had a wonderful Mother's Day and can understand with a tweet of the day that we're going to be covering why it's so important to drop the term mother and to use the term birthing people. It is much more inclusive. It applies to all those non-cisgendered females who give birth. Now, how that works exactly, we will explain all on the Michael Medved Show. Also, why there is a controversy now with threats of death and brandishing weapons about the song "The Eyes of Texas Are Upon You." It is the spirit song, the fight song for the University of Texas Longhorns. And the big controversy right now in the Lone Star State is not the reform of voting procedures, which of course has been treated like the crack of doom, which it is not, but the debate about whether the song to the tune of "I've Been Working on the Railroad" should be allowed to continue. There's a great deal of our popular culture that would have to be scrapped if they actually do prevail in scrapping "The Eyes of Texas." This is a fight with an intensity level you will find it hard to believe. You will also find it hard to believe that Democrats are saying it's short-sighted to obsess about the $6 trillion price tag of Joe Biden's spending plans. We will get to that. We'll also be talking to Bjorn Lomborg about whether dealing with climate change, and Bjorn Lomborg is one of the world's leading experts on this subject, truly is, and respected widely, not universally, but widely on this issue. Talk to him whether there is going to have to be a readjustment about the American diet, giving up meat and other animal-based products for purely plant-based food. Is that in the offing? Stephen Moore has a column in Wall Street Journal today that says, no, really, really, the Biden administration is planning to get rid of cheeseburgers and other foods that are favorites before the 4th of July. I think that's unlikely, actually, but we will get to that issue as well. 1-800-955-1776. And you're thinking, what? He's not going to talk about Liz Cheney versus Kevin McCarthy versus Donald Trump and the Republican Armageddon? Yeah, we'll talk about it. But honestly, I think that the entire fight on all sides is just bad for the country and bad for the Republican Party. But we will get to that as well. First up, there's a collage, which I think is actually very entertaining, that prepares you for understanding that Mother's Day in the future is going to have to be changed to Birthing People's Day. And for all of us here at the Medved Show, we hope that you sent text messages to the person who birthed you, whether that person be heteronormative, cis, trans, or anything else. Maybe you even gave him, her, or they some followers to celebrate the fact that they're a birthing person. However you celebrated Birthing People's Day, bless you for doing so. Here are the sentiments as put together in a collage by Grabian. Listen.
Going to Mother's Day weekend, let us recommit our efforts and support to ensure that every birthing person across this nation is empowered and feels safe.
All pregnant and birthing people deserve to be treated with love.
Birthing while Black should not be a death sentence.
Health equity for Black birthing people is attainable.
Desperately need long-term fixes to support the healthcare needs of Black women and birthing people.
The most marginalized, Black and Indigenous birthing people.
And respectful of Black women and birthing people.
The maternal mortality crisis among Black birthing people in the United States.
Black birthing people
and birthing people.
That birthing people want doulas and midwives.
And support for birthing people during the postpartum period.
Protect Black birthing people and to save lives.
Okay. Is there anyone out there, honestly, who believes that this term birthing people should be used to replace the term mothers? And the whole idea of a birthing person, what is exactly a birthing person? That is explained in the source that explains nearly everything in our society, Twitter. And that brings us to our tweet of the day.
Turn the page now to the internet.
I mean, wow, what a great, smart tweet.
Change his password so he no longer has access to his Twitter feed.
Did you send the tweet?
I did not send that tweet. My system was hacked. I was pranked.
Donald Trump hasn't tweeted at us once, and I'm starting to get worried about him.
So we have a new tweet.
All right.
Can I do the honors?
Stand by. Tweet alert.
Okay, the tweet of the day is from NARAL, the National Abortion Rights Action League, they have gotten involved celebrating birth instead of abortion this time. I guess that's a good thing. But they tweeted out, when we talk about birthing people, we're being inclusive. It's that simple. We use gender-neutral language when talking about pregnancy because it's not just cisgender women that can get pregnant and give birth. Reproductive freedom is for everybody. Okay, so what are they talking about here? Who else can give birth other than women? Well, transgendered males. Okay, follow. If you are born a woman, but you choose to identify as a male, and you haven't removed all of your feminine equipment, maybe you just had what they call a top job, which you can imagine what that is. Then you can pretend that you're a male and still give birth using the other part of your equipment that hasn't been removed. Now, the number of people for whom this is the case, what do you think? You think 1% of all births are actually by transgendered males? By women who now believe they are male. By the way, they do not want to compete in male sports. That's not an issue. But the bias for the bizarre, actually, it's something I wrote about a long time ago in my book, Hollywood versus America. There is a bias for the bizarre here. And this entire focus, I know there's one, a quote, former female who's given birth at least twice, I think three times, down in Oregon, someone who was married to a woman. She used to be a woman. She now identifies as a man, but she's given birth, and apparently I believe she's nursed even. And the idea that giving birth and nursing would still allow you to qualify as a male is part of the confusion and part of the insanity and part of the bias for the bizarre that is unfortunately taken hold in our country, where we are coming close to an apocalypse of craziness, to use one phrase. Speaking of which, we're going to talk about the crisis in jobs. Actually finding people to fill the jobs that are available. The battle on the Texas fight song. Yes, it's a serious battle. And China's annual emissions surpassing those of all the developed nations combined. What does that mean for climate change? We'll be talking with Bjorn Lomborg about that and much more coming up on The Medved Show. on the Michael Medved Show, are we really at the end of the world, basically facing the collapse of American democracy? Thomas Friedman, and again, generally, I think you can assume that the side that is most likely to talk about an apocalypse is usually a side that is not doing well politically. And given the fact that the Biden administration hasn't had any major disasters yet, I mean, I think they may be heading for them if some of the economic plans are put into operation. But there's this piece by Tom Friedman at the New York Times that is so overstated. He's a double Pulitzer Prize winner. And he begins in this cheerful spring season by saying, we are not okay. America's democracy is still in real danger. In fact, we are closer to a political civil war more than at any other time in our modern history. Today's seeming political calm is actually resting on a false bottom that we're at risk of crashing through at any moment. Under Trump's command and control from Mar-a-Lago, with the complicity of most of his party's leaders, that big lie that the greatest election in our history, when more Republicans and Democrats voted than ever before in the midst of a pandemic, must have been rigged because Trump lost. That big lie has metastasized. It's being embraced by a solid majority of elected Republicans and ordinary party members, local, state, and national. This is not an exaggeration, Friedman writes. Here's what Representative Anthony Gonzalez, one of the few Republicans who voted to impeach Trump, told The Hill about the campaign. Within the party, to oust Representative Liz Cheney from her House GOP leadership position because of her refusal to go along with the big lie. You know, it's, again, to say refusal to go along with the big lie, when there's a refusal to reconcile, and basically to say, okay, we disagree, let's put that behind us and concentrate on working together. That's a refusal on both sides. Do I think it's stupid to be making this huge deal over Liz Cheney right now? Yes, it's very stupid. It doesn't help the party at all. But do I believe that it represents the end of America? This is not an exaggeration, writes Tom Friedman. Here's what Representative Anthony Gonzalez, one of the few Republicans who voted to impeach Trump, told The Hill about the campaign within the party to oust Liz Cheney from her House GOP leadership position. Quote, if a prerequisite for leading our conference is continuing to tie our voters, is continuing to tie to our voters, then Liz is not the best fit. Liz isn't going to lie to people. She's going to stand on principle, et cetera, et cetera. And then he says, think about that for a moment. To be a leader in today's GOP, you either have to play dumb or be dumb in the central issue facing our republic, the integrity of our election. Is that really the central issue facing our republic right now? The issue was settled. I mean, do I think that stuff like the recount in Arizona is stupid and pointless and destructive and hurtful to the party? It is, absolutely. But do I think that making a huge fight on this issue now is only a way of resuscitating Trump, who's been kind of quiet? I know he put out the idea that it was the big lie to say that Biden was the president, but honest to goodness, wouldn't it be better for everybody to leave this issue alone, right? Kimberly Whale, a professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law, noted that as of late March, state legislatures have introduced 361 bills in 47 states this year that contain limitations around voting, a 43% increase from just a month earlier. when they talk about limitations around voting, what they're mostly talking about is adjusting the special arrangements that were made for a pandemic. And honestly, if you look at the ability of people to vote with the existing rules that happened in last fall, the idea that any of these end up taking people's right to vote away is just misstated. And here's what Friedman says that I think is outrageous. He says, imagine if all or many of these measures are passed. And in 2022 and 2024, Republicans managed to retake the House, Senate, and White House with, say, only 42% of the popular vote, effectively establishing minority rule. Do you know what will happen? Let me tell you what will happen, says Tom Friedman. Disenfranchised Democratic voters will not sit idly by. They may refuse to pay their taxes. Many will take to the streets. Some might become violent. And our whole political system could become paralyzed and start to unravel. Basically, he's threatening people. And the idea, by the way, it is not possible for the Republicans to win only 42% of the vote and then to take over the presidency and the Senate and the House. It won't happen. It never has. Not with that level of support. I mean, honestly, putting this in context, it seems to me is extraordinarily important. And it's also important to put into context some of the other threats facing the country. One of them, which of course has been greatly overhyped as a coming apocalypse, is the climate situation. By the way, do I believe that it's a good idea to reduce greenhouse gases? Absolutely. But there is a new study that shows that China's annual emissions surpass those of all developed nations combined. China's annual emissions exceed those of all developed nations combined in 2019, because they do the measures retroactively. It's the first time this has happened since national greenhouse gas emissions have been measured, according to a new report from the Rhodium Group. Chinese President Xi Jinping has vowed to make his country carbon neutral by 2060, and climate policy is seen as a major area of cooperation and even competition between the U.S. and China. But the new report highlights how difficult reducing China's impact on the climate could be, according to the researchers. Okay, so what's the Biden administration going to do about it? What should they do about it? We'll be speaking to Bjørn Lomborg, president of the Copenhagen Consensus Center and a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. Coming right up on The Medved Show.
I'm, of course, deeply honored to receive
The Michael Medved Show.
Show. Bjørn Lomborg is the president of the Copenhagen Consensus Center. He is a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford, and he was named for his work on climate change one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people in the world. His most recent book is called False Alarm: How Climate Change Panic Costs Us Trillions, Hurts the Poor, and Fails to Fix the Planet. Bjorn, thanks very much for joining us, first of all.
Michael, it's always great to be here.
Thank you. And what do we make of the new revelation about China far not only exceeding the United States in its emissions, but actually exceeding all the other developed nations combined? How could that be?
Well, I think, Michael, it's not a revelation because it's been in the offing for a very long time, but I think it crystallized what people need to realize about climate change. climate change is now no longer a rich world issue. It is mostly about emissions from the developing world. So, as you know, the rich world emits about a quarter of all emissions, and so does China by itself. And the rest of the developing world is almost 50%. So the reality here now is that most of the world's emissions, and that's true for the rest of the century, will come from poor countries, or today's poor countries. And that tells you this is not predominantly about rich, well-meaning people cutting a little bit of CO2. It is about how do we convince poor countries to stop emitting as much CO2. And, of course, we're not going to do that as long as their primary goal is to get their people out of poverty.
How are we going to do that? And in other words, how do you change that goal? Do you just pay them to get out of poverty? What do you do?
No. You have to realize that for most people on this planet, there are much more important issues than temperatures in 100 years. It matters about their kids dying from easily curable infectious diseases, not enough food, not enough education, not enough progress and development to go around. They are not going to give up on that. What we need to do is to develop, and that is innovate green energy that's cheaper than fossil fuels. The reason why China is putting up so many coal-fired power plants and the reason why India and everybody else is because that's the only and cheap way to get reliable power. If we could innovate green energy that was cheaper than fossil fuels, they would pick that in a heartbeat. I mean, coal-fired power also pollutes a lot, just air pollution drives a lot of people to their death. So there's a lot to be gained from this, but they're not going to give up on development. We need to recognize it's not enough to try to cajole them to buy expensive green energy. What we need to do is to focus on innovation to get much cheaper green energy in the future.
Will this mean that it will be the responsible of the wealthier countries, led, of course, by the United States, because we're the biggest of them, for the wealthier countries to actually provide or develop energy for countries that are developing?
Well, in some sense, this is something that we could all agree on, and we actually have. You probably heard about the Paris Agreement in 2015, where Obama and everybody else promised they were going to cut carbon emissions a lot. And, of course, we're not actually living up to most of those promises. But on the sidelines, we promised something else. We promised that we were going to spend a lot more on energy innovation. Remember, spending money on innovation is much, much cheaper than spending money on actually buying expensive and inefficient energy technology today. Unfortunately, most of our conversation is about putting up the next set of wind turbines or solar panels to make ourselves feel good. But what we really should be doing is spending less money, much more smartly, on funding a lot of smart researchers to come up with better ideas. If you think back in the 1950s in Los Angeles, it was a terribly polluted place. The solution in Los Angeles in the 1950s was not to tell everyone, I'm sorry, could you just start running or walking or you know, biking instead? The solution was technological. It was the catalytic converter. We innovated. Yeah, it cost a little bit of money, but suddenly everybody could drive much longer and actually not pollute the air very much. That's the smart technological solution, and we need the same thing for green energy. So the U.S. shouldn't take the starting position to put up more and more solar panels and wind turbines. You should be spending money on innovation to get the next generations of smarter, cheaper, and more effective green energy forms that will actually take over the world.
What a brilliant concept. Let me ask you a question. We hear a lot in the United States about a Green New Deal. Sounds like what you're talking about is a green Marshall Plan, maybe, or a green space shot or moon program, something of that nature.
It's a little bit like that. It's a little bit like that. But the important part is it's much, much cheaper. So, you know, to put it very bluntly, the Green New Deal and most other climate plans are talking about spending many, many trillions of dollars every year on trying to cut carbon emissions in the way to force people to use power that is not yet competitive. What I'm talking about and what the smart money tells us, and this is also what some of the world's top climate economists that I've worked together with, including three Nobel laureates, point out, this is the smartest long-term proposal. That is to spend tens of billions of dollars, so much less than what we're spending on climate today, but smartly into energy innovation. So, look, do you remember Craig Venter? He's the innovator who cracked the human genome back in 2000. He has this idea that he can grow algae out on the ocean surface. They will soak up sunlight and CO2, and then they'll produce oil. So we can basically keep our entire fossil fuel energy infrastructure. We'll put in oil in our cars. But the beauty is, because it just captured the CO2 out on the ocean surface, it is essentially CO2 neutral. Now, this doesn't work right now. It works in principle, but it's not commercially viable at all. But we should invest in him innovating that. Now, there's a good chance that's not going to work. But that's the nature of innovation. If we fund thousands of these ideas, we really just need one or a few of these ideas to come true. And that's what will power the 21st century. Because obviously, not only rich, well-meaning Americans, but also the Chinese, the Indians, the Africans will buy this technology and use it if it's cheaper than fossil fuels.
What a tremendously important message. To find out more about it, check out Bjorn's latest book. It is called False Alarm: How Climate Change Panic Costs Us Trillions, Hurts the Poor, and Fails to Fix the Planet. With that oil that they would make from algae absorbing sunlight, I hope it wouldn't ruin all beaches or end the life of fisheries. I assume that it would.
His plan, of course, is that it should be out on the middle of the ocean. But look, there's obviously there's going to be problems with any.
Obviously, nothing is simple and nothing is immediate, but clearly what leadership needs to do. And again, what an opportunity for Republicans to offer an alternative to the Green New Deal that would have to do with emphasizing this new development, which, very much like the vaccine, could best be done by harnessing private enterprise. We'll be right back.
No,
and that
not at
is
all.
One of the emphases in a False Alarm: How Climate Change Panic Costs Us Trillions, Hurts the Poor, and Fails to Fix the Planet. It's posted on our website at michaelmedved.com. We'll be right back.
The Michael Medved Show, all across America.
It's dangerous for America. It's dangerous for the world.
This is the Michael Medved Show. Become a Medhead member today.
Michael, my wife and I are Medhead members, and we've listened to you for years.
Commercial-free podcasts, commentaries, find out more at michaelmedved.com. Michael Medved.
Here you go again.
There's a Washington Post headline that it has a certain duh factor to it. And you wonder, honestly, do people who actually read the Washington Post, is the assumption that no one has common sense? The headline, should you say the N-word? Do you think you know the answer to that? And we will get to that issue and the way it impacts the University of Texas Longhorns coming up on the Michael Medved Show. There is some news today that actually, I think, hits on a lot of what is going on in the Republican Party. And it's sad news. It's news of the death of a politician that I greatly respected and who will be missed. Now, he's been out of the limelight for a while. He was 86 years old when Pete DuPont died. He was a governor of Delaware. And it's relevant now because he obviously represented a different school of Republican, not ideologically, but stylistically. And there's also a note that except for a little quirk of fate, Pete DuPont of Delaware could have blocked the advance of Joe Biden to the White House. Now, how did that work? The fascinating thing about him is, of course, he came from one of the richest families in America. He wasn't quite a Rockefeller, but he was a DuPont. And he got into politics somewhat reluctantly after his schooling and after experience as a yachtsman and experience in the family business, which, again, is the DuPont Company, which is highly successful and obviously very prominent in Delaware. And he won the governorship in 1976, which you will remember was a very bad year for Republicans. Republicans didn't win the House. They didn't win the Senate. They lost both very badly. And they lost the presidency to Jimmy Carter. And yet, in what was at that time considered a swing state in Delaware, DuPont won by 57 to 42% against an incumbent. And then this is the way the New York Times summarizes his term. He signed into law two income tax cuts, the first in Delaware's modern history, and a constitutional amendment that limited government spending and future tax increases. Mr. DuPont also recruited talented professionals for top state posts, and he aggressively pursued new businesses for the state with generous tax incentives and deregulation to set the stage for prosperity. He was reelected 4 years later with 71% of the vote. Did you hear that? In Delaware. In Delaware. Mr. DuPont helped establish Delaware as a paradise for the credit card industry with a law in 1981 that eliminated usury restrictions for state banks, allowing assessments of high interest rates for credit card customers no matter where they resided, a law intended to attract two banks and 1,000 plus jobs to Delaware, eventually drew 30 banks to the state, creating 43,000 financial service jobs. Now, that's a big deal in a little state. The governor's approval ratings approached 90%. Let that sink in. This is a Republican governor, very conservative Republican governor in a Democratic state. By the time he left office in 1985, the state's economy was humming, with unemployment down to 7% from a high of 13%. The top tax rate had been cut in half, and state budgets were balanced every year of his term. Even the Democrats praised his performance. He would have gone for a third term as governor, but they had term limits. And Mr. DuPont was widely expected to challenge Delaware's incumbent Democratic U.S. Senator, Joe Biden. Instead, he began preparing for a presidential race in 1986, nearly a year and a half before the primary season. He became the first candidate of either party to announce his candidacy. Now, listen to this. His agenda was a mix of conservative and libertarian ideas. Its centerpiece was an alternative retirement system, offering Social Security recipients a choice of private savings options in exchange for cuts in government benefits. He also called for phasing out farm subsidies, requiring people on welfare to work, providing parents vouchers to send their children to any school they chose, and random drug testing for high school students, with offenders losing their driver's licenses. The proposals made headlines, but his 1988 campaign never gained traction. And what's fascinating here is when you look at the five guys who made it to the New Hampshire primary and competed, George W. Bush was vice president. Bob Dole was a leader in the Senate. He had been a vice presidential nominee before. Jack Kemp was a former congressman and had been in Reagan's cabinet. And Pete DuPont and Pat Robertson, the religious broadcaster. And what's fascinating about that group is so many of them were, well, certainly George Bush was the son of a U.S. senator. Pat Robertson was the son of a U.S. senator. His father, A. Willis Robinson, had been a senator from Virginia. And then, of course, Pete DuPont, scion of an extremely prominent family. Bob Dole from a very humble background in Russell, Kansas. But this goes to another column that was written over the weekend by Matt Bye, who was talking about the old spirit of the Republican Party, which was a lot of people who were parts of dynasties, people who were part of the Romney dynasty. Yeah, Mitt Romney, his father was a long-term governor. Liz Cheney, her father, obviously, Vice President of the United States. George W. Bush, who was spoken out. And even Lisa Murkowski, her father was both governor of Alaska and longtime senator from Alaska before she took the position. And he's lamenting the loss of some of those dynasties. You could say the Republican establishment. But if you actually look at some of the ideas that people like Jack Kemp and Pete DuPont injected into the political bloodstream, I almost said drug stream. No, we're not talking about DuPont drugs. They were radical and energizing and helped to fuel future conservative reform efforts like the welfare reform that was highly successful that Newt Gingrich helped to structure when the Republicans took over the House in 1994. Now, all of this is by way of tribute to a guy like Pete DuPont, who most people probably don't even think about today. But it's also that idea of broadening what it means to be a Republican. And what it means to be a Republican should not be arguing with fellow Republicans about who is a real conservative and who is a true American patriot and who is not a true American patriot. What the party needs desperately right now is new ideas. To answer, as Bjorn Lomborg was saying, answer the Green New Deal with a green moonshot, with a green... one of the things that obviously... there's no aspect of the climate change crisis that can't be at least ameliorated, at least improved, by some more juice and support for technology. And a green Marshall Plan, the Marshall Plan was designed to help countries that were impoverished and largely destroyed by World War II. And obviously, providing some kind of technological help and know-how and ability for some of those developed countries that are now contributing, as Bjorn pointed out, if you count China, which is half of the entire emissions problem, the other developing countries doing another full one quarter, that's 75% of all of the emissions. If you really do want to slow down the pace of climate change, then obviously you have to do something about that. Looking at the world in a broader light, trying to figure out how to fix things, not just how to destroy your opponents, that might be a useful direction for the Republican Party to take. And avoiding stupid conflicts like the current conflict over the eyes of Texas are upon you. We will get to that dispute and much, much more in this greatest nation on God's green earth.